My name is Rachel Rofe. I created the show because I wanted to help you see that if you have a choice, you can choose a better life. If you're listening to this podcast, you're in a pretty fortunate position. You have free will, ability to connect to the internet, and access to all kinds of new education. This podcast is meant to help you make the most of your good fortune. We talk with all kinds of people here from all walks of life because I want you to see that no matter what your situation, there's always a way to create a life that you're proud of. Hello. So in today's episode, we're going to be speaking with Dale Partridge, who is just incredible. I was feeling so intimidated before we started this podcast because I just think the guy is incredible. I mean, as you're going to hear, he has founded a bunch of companies. One of the companies is called Sevenly. And what that company does, if you haven't heard of it, is basically every time any piece of merchandise is sold, they donate $7 to a charity. And their charities end up switching over every single week. And so since he's launched the company, they've donated over $4.2 million to various charities around the world. So just incredible. He has this book called People Over Profit, and it just really talks about how to create a company that is a good company, like really solid values that can actually do really well. And he talks about in our interview how a lot of companies go through this four-part era where they start out really wanting to make the world better and have really great missions, and then they go into efficiency and then this area of deception. And so we talk about that, and then they get into the apologetic era, and that's the four-part cycle. But we talk about how you can avoid that altogether. So we cover that. We cover just what Dale's life looks like now, what's important to him, how he was able to create so many multi-million dollar companies, because Sevenly was just one of them. And we talk about how he deals with fear and just all kinds of important things to him. And then at the very end, we touch just a little bit on his social media followings and how he is able to have such a huge following, because he has over 700,000 Pinterest followers, 756,000 Pinterest followers, 142,000 on Twitter. And that's just for his main name. He also has, for his companies, more hundreds of thousands of followers. So I learned a lot from this, and I hope that you really enjoy it too. All right, here we go. Thank you so much for being here, Dale.
Hey, thanks for having me. Super stoked to share my story and hopefully let your listeners walk away with something they can use.
I'm sure that's going to happen. So the intention behind A Better Life is to show people that if they have a choice, they can choose a better life. So in that spirit, can you take a minute to just share with us some of the things that you're most proud of in your life?
Yeah, you know, for a long time, I wanted to be a successful entrepreneur, and I thought that was kind of the purpose of life for me, and I made a lot of progress there, and built many multi-million dollar companies, and I think as I've gotten older, I'm learning that the most important things in life are being a great husband and being a great father and being a great friend and a great son and a great older brother. And I'm trying to really look at lives of people that I follow. I used to follow people that were really successful in business, and I was like, yeah, like that's great. What I've kind of tipped it on its head and said, hey, how can I start finding people that are not just really good at business and successful there, but also have like really incredibly like strong families and a great marriage and a great name in the community and are wise. And so I'm trying to look for more of these people now. And the goal, you know, for me is to watch my kids run around in the backyard. So that's the exciting part, is I'm shifting a little bit into some clarity there.
Oh, I love it. And I wasn't expecting that answer. So now I'm so curious. Who are some of the people that you're following?
Well, they're not people you're going to find on social media. But I have a couple of people I can tell you shortly about. One of them is, his name is Jim Van Eerden. He's the chairman of my past company that I founded, Sevenly. And he's got, 10 children. And he, his last one that he had, he adopted with Down syndrome, and he's got his boys and respect him, and his daughters adore him. And his wife and his marriage are strong. He's ran multi-million dollar companies and does charity work. And he's just a spiritual leader. He's a great all around guy. And these people are very rare. Another guy in my my realm who's here located in Bend, Oregon with me, his name's Matthew Jacobson. who's got 8 kids, and very similar. Just this idea where it's like his focus is not just to be successful at work or successful at home. And I know people that are good at both. You know, I know lots of people that are great dads and husbands, but they're just, they have very little purpose at work. It's a unique dynamic when you're like extra good at all three of them. And, so they're just some, Matt Jacobson, you could find him online. He's got a little bit of a following, but, so yeah, that's been the shift, and it's been such a cool journey to just kind of shift my gaze in a different direction.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm also curious because I remember reading that you're really competitive, or you were really competitive. How does that play into changing your focus to being more into family?
As a business guy, I'm super competitive. I'm also competitive with myself mostly. So meaning that I'm constantly trying to get better and I'm constantly trying to grow. And I'm addicted almost to growth. And I'm learning to find the balance in that because I think that sometimes the way that how addicted I am might not be good. I'm looking more to patience. And for example, like I'm trying to teach where I'm really comfortable and not teach where I'm not really comfortable. And I think that many men especially, I know this is happening obviously for women too, but just from my experience with men is that they want to start teaching on things before they're you know, seasoned in them. And so for me, it's the competitiveness in me that says, oh, I'm ready. I can do this. And so writing this book was a hard thing because I had to really say, like, can I really write this book? And I felt confident with 11 years of entrepreneurial experience under my belt that I could. And I hope that my books coming in the future will have that kind of cred. But I also have said no to a lot of things that I go, man, I'm just not ready to talk about that yet. And that's hard because I want to win. I want to win now. And so it's helped me a lot. And it's helped me realize again, that the most important thing in the world is the relationships that we have.
I love that. And I really love that you mentioned about not wanting to teach things until you've learned them, because I think it's become really popular for people to say we teach what we need to learn. And something about that just doesn't sit right with me. I'd rather people either get a good grip on it first or master it before they go and teach that.
Absolutely.
So I have been just really excited. I was saying right before we got started how excited I am about your book and just talking with you. And I want to dive into that. So to give people some context just about the type of companies that you founded, because I know you founded seven now, or is it more?
It's seven still.
Okay. Awesome. So can you share with Sevenly in particular, since you referenced that so many times in the book, just what the purpose was behind it and like the tangible results from it?
Sure. Yeah. I started as an entrepreneur going into fitness companies, and then I started a rock climbing gym, and I got fired from my own company, which is a story we could talk about later if we want. And learned a lot about leadership, learned about who I am, started a branding agency, a conference company. And then I all of a sudden got to the point where I go, you know what? Making six figures and stuffing my pockets with money, success wasn't fixing me. And I realized that I wanted to figure out how I could blend purpose and profit. And what did that look like? I started asking the hard questions, and I started flipping capitalism upside down. And I wanted to create a philosophy out of the things that I was already doing in my mind and the way that I was running my companies. I was always very different in the way that I thought about employees, the way that I thought about leadership. And I wanted to really implement those principles. So I started a company called Sevenly in 2011 with my business partner out of a desire to, I realized, I wanted to help people. I wanted to do something with charities. And I realized that I wasn't the guy that I so badly wanted to be, the guy that you would see a photo of me like digging a well in Africa, or like Blake Mykowski from Tom's Shoes, like putting my, kid's shoes on in Peru. But I wasn't that guy. And I had to be okay with that. I wasn't called to the field. I was called to the people, called to the field. And this was hard for me to swallow, but I said, okay, well, what does this look like in a business? People that follow me know that I'm a Christian guy. I try to be as real as it can get from that perspective, because I know a lot of Christians live a pretty ugly life on the outside. And I remember asking the question. I said, okay, if Jesus started a company, what would it look like? And I wanted to figure out, like, we church and stuff and Christians, they always talk about, things outside of business, and they almost separate it. I'm like, no, I like, yeah. I don't think Jesus changes wherever he's at. I mean, I think if you started a company, what would it really look like? So I started asking some hard questions, and I came up with the idea of Sevenly, where every week we'd partner with a new nonprofit. We would give $7 of every item sold to a charity. So if we sold 1,000 products in a week, we would give that charity $7,000. And it was cause first. It was like helping people. And I remember the lesson that I learned is that, you know, building a $1 million company wasn't even on my radar. It was just a result of what I was doing. And I had to stop seeing money as the primary goal, but rather as a product of helping 1 million people.
Mm.
And so I shifted into that mindset, and I just got lost in helping people. And all of a sudden I looked out, and 2.5 years later, we've given away $4.2 million, grew the company to almost 50 employees and almost $10 million in revenue. And I was on the cover of magazines, and I was traveling the world and speaking to 3,000 Facebook employees at their headquarters, and everything just worked. And I thought, wow, like what a cool thing to just focus on the right things, and things typically work. That was the experience there, and the philosophies that I had implemented at Sevenly over the 3.5 years that I was there. I'd recently sold my stock in the company, the lessons I learned there and the philosophy of my business, I think, really got a chance for me to put into practice what I was thinking, and it worked. And then that's why I wrote the book, People Over Profit, that I think will help teach the lessons that worked for me, as well as that are working for like some of the biggest companies in the world, and help people, create better companies.
Awesome. And can you explain real quick why you opted to create a new charity every week? Because I think this is a really powerful message for people.
Yeah. So one thing is, it was super stressful. So I remember my friend, kind of mentor at the time, was like, "Dale, you created a hell of a model for peace in your life. Every week you got to create new products and a new campaign and a new marketing strategy and a new charity, and it was a lot of work." To do that. But I think people are really, they're addicted to variety. And I think that, you know, not everybody cares about the same issues. So like having that chance for every week, a new option. And I think people also wanted to create a purchase with a purpose. And they wanted to have that guilt-free buying experience. And so we became the ability for people to give in the daily things that they spend. Like, you're going to buy a shirt anyways. Like, you might as well buy it from us and then feed a child for a month. So I think that connection there was really helpful in the growth of the company.
Yeah, and one of the things that I just loved about that concept is, you know, so many people talk about having this elusive purpose or this one thing that they're so passionate about. And what I love is that it doesn't need to be one specific thing if you're not tied to like one particular thing that you want to support. It's all these different ones. So you're still doing good, but it doesn't have to be in a very tight kind of fashion.
Exactly. And there's so many causes out there, right? Like, we don't need to be just stuck with food, or we don't need to be stuck with just water. I think that opening your eyes to what's really happening in the world, which is a really hard thing to do. A lot of people they see it, they mentally believe it. But if they emotionally believe it, they actually have to do something about it. And so I don't think a lot of people emotionally believe when they see people dying from starvation, or when they, you know, are sex trafficking. Like, they don't want to emotionally believe it, because that means they'd actually have to change and they'd have to do something about it. And so our goal is try to help people emotionally get it and say, hey, it's time to make a move. And I think that's what really made us successful.
Yeah, I mean, with over $4.2 million at this point, I would say so.
Yeah, in $7 donations, right? That's the weird part, is that they're all in tiny donations.
It's crazy. So awesome. I'm just so inspired by this. As soon as I was telling you before, I started reading the book when I was getting a blowout. I got home and I immediately went over to my boyfriend, who's launching part clothing. There's all kinds of merchandise. And I just told him about you and how just pumped I was. Just such good stuff. So in People Over Profit, you share that most businesses in America go through this four-part cycle. Well, actually, before I go into that, can you just give just a brief overview of each era?
Yeah, so I learned, you know, the big thing was I was wondering, why was my company working? I thought, holy crap, like how is it that I'm giving 23% of our top-line revenue away and we're still growing and people love it? And I wondered, you know, is this something that we do differently, and why aren't other companies doing it? And then I started realizing that there was other companies that had been giving but faded away from it. And I learned of other companies that had great startup stories but were horrible companies now. And I thought, wow, like companies change, especially over like long periods of time. And I realized after doing my research that all companies start in what I call the honest era. It's because they have to. I mean, they can't be dishonest. They go out of business. And they start with this beautiful mission and they're focused. And then over time, they start to forget, you know, kind of fueled by growth and a little bit of a lack of control of their growth. They move into what I call the efficient era. And this is an era of time where you know, assembly lines and outsourcing and some of these eras or some of these attributes of kind of growth and mainstreaming and you know, this is when a company used to do all their stuff in America and then they outsource it to China, right? Or when they used to have somebody answer the phone and now they have a call center. And then they don't even really know that they're there. But then it's when a company goes from there to the next era, which is the third era, which is the deceptive era, where they've, you know, this might be 20, 30 years after they started. It could even be as little as 10 years, but it's when a company forgets really who they are. And, you know, I sometimes use Bank of America as this example. I mean, if you hear their startup story, which is too long of a story for us today, but they have an incredible startup story. And you're like, wow, I love that company. Who is that? And then you go, it's Bank of America. And you go, what? and you look at them now and they got a lot of bad brand perception. I mean, most anybody you say, hey, do you think that Bank of America values people over profit or profit over people? There's very few people that will say that oh yeah, they value people over profit. And so they find themselves in a deceptive era where a change in leadership and seasons and transition and they're different than when they started. They're not the same company. And typically companies that fall into that era either have to go backwards into the efficient era or back in the honest era, but they often almost die or they struggle or they, you know, competitors come up and they're starting to overtake their market share and they push them into what I call the fourth era, which is the final era, which is the apologetic era. And this is an era of regaining consumer trust and kind of rebuilding that relationship between you and the people that you serve. And it requires like extreme vulnerability and transparency on authenticity and honesty and generosity and courage. And I talk about that. So the ultimate goal of the book is to say, hey, this era sucks or this cycle sucks. Like we don't even want to do this cycle. I don't want to have a company that is honest and then all of a sudden is efficient, then all of a sudden is deceptive, and then all of a sudden has to go to an apologetic era to get back to the honest era. I don't want that. How do we just skip this all together and just stay honest all the time? And who's done that? And what are they doing to do that? And that's what the book's about. I mean, it's talking about, well, you know, I see companies that have been in business for 20 plus years with great brand perceptions, high employee retention rates, and they do things that are super unique. And it's the funny thing is that none of them know that they do them. they don't realize it's not on their mission statement. It's not in their core values. It's not on their you know, tattooed on the wall in their corporate HQ. It's not the things you're going to find in Fortune or Forbes or you know, Fast Company magazine. These are things that these leaders know that are the timeless principles that they learned like in kindergarten. Like when their parents taught them to not lie and to share and to like care for one another and to be kind. And it sounds too simple to be true, but it's very difficult. If it was not that difficult, then everybody would be doing it. But the leaders of people over profit companies like Patagonia and Whole Foods and North Face and REI and Chick-fil-A and In-N-Out and some of these other great brands that have had this success, their leaders are just really incredible, core, foundational, timeless principle type people. And that's what I'm saying. Hey, this is my philosophy on business. This is these people's philosophy on business. Here's what it looks like and here's how you can adopt it.
What are the things that you think are in their mindset to be able to keep these? I know you share that there's seven core beliefs in the book. How do they keep those beliefs?
It's very difficult. I mean, I think that it requires a leader that's capable of what I actually say in the book is they're constitutionally incapable of operating without them. And it takes a focus. I mean, it takes a focus on you know, valuing people, right? It takes a focus on telling the truth, you know, completely and clearly. And it, you know, it's hard to be authentic and transparent and to focus on those things, and quality, keeping quality high, and generosity and courage. I mean, these are the things that I talk about. And it's hard because they're big terms, you know, and you got to have a leader that says, I'm willing to figure out what this big term looks like tactically in business and in my business and with customers.
Yeah. And I have some, I mean, so like, for example, with, and I don't know, I'm sure you still do what you were doing with the hiring and firing with Sevenly.
Yep.
Can you explain that process? Because I think it puts these beliefs in just such clear format.
Yeah. So I kind of reinvented the golden rule. And I said, you know, the golden rule changed to fire people the way you would like to be fired. And I remember looking at that and I go, firing is a really crappy day for anybody. And why the way we do it is not really honorable to anybody either. And it's funny because we ask employees to give 2-week notices to us when they leave, yet that we just drop them on the hat, you know, we just say, hey, you're fired today. Go look for a job tomorrow, you know? So I said, hey, why don't we start giving them notice or saying, hey, giving them like a small severance package, even if they're not a long-term employee. So, you know, hey, we're gonna have to let you go, which we'd always do on a Friday. We'd always do at the end of the day. And we'd always speak to the problem, not the person. And we would always, you know, I would even write them a letter of recommendation for the things that they're good at. And also I wanted to, you know, like, remember, like, they have mortgages and bills and children and spouses and all those things that we have too. And say, hey, you know, just letting you know, if you need your benefits extended a little bit, we can see if we can do that. You know, we want to also give you 2 weeks of pay to help you through that too. And, we try to do this for as many people as possible. And we would say often, you know, hey, if you use your laptop to make money, like, maybe we can figure out a way you can keep your laptop. And what changed, I think, a big way is that we'd actually ask them if they'd want to come back, you know, the following Monday and let the entire staff go around and tell them how much they mean to us and how great they are. And so we would see about 80% of the employees that would do this, and they would come back and they would sit in the center of the room, and we would say, hey, you know, oh man, John, you are so, like, every day I walked in and you smiled and you're so funny and you made working here better. And then someone else would say, you know, your art was so incredible that every time I wake up in the morning, I look at your Instagram and you inspire me. And then the next person. And it's just this affirmation process where they go and they leave and they don't feel like a past employee. They feel like alumni. Mm. And so we really try to, things like that is what people over profit companies do. We shift, we change, we break the system, right? We break the system to create a better version of capitalism that's not so disgusting and rude and mean. It's hard. It's really hard to do. But I think that the premise of the book is that if, you know, I believe that if you value people over profit, you'll actually be more profitable.
Yeah. And, you know, I agree. And I think even just the profitable in terms of emotion and realizing that you've lived your life to the fullest and you can just feel like a good person.
Right. Like that's huge. Like you go home and you feel good. You don't have to worry about people hating you. And it takes a maturity. It takes a leadership and emotional maturity to do this. And it's a mature book for mature thinkers. I hope that the goal is to get, you know, I'm trying to sell as many copies as I can to get it on the New York Times list so that we can get this in the hands of the CEOs of the biggest companies in the world. You get the CEO of Bank of America to read this and adopt it. I mean, what does that do for the 30,000 employees they have, you know? Changes lives.
Absolutely. And even just writing your book, you did it in a way where you were valuing people over profit. I loved at the end how you were talking about how so many books have so much fluff and how you just got yours right to the point because you knew that that's what you would want.
Right. Nobody likes a long book, especially business people. I guess if you're reading a fiction novel, you might like a long book. But I mean, business people hate long books. And I hate it when it's like dragged on for like pages. I'm like, oh God. So I tried to make really short chapters. Really cool graphics, and just keep it simple and light. and not focus so much on length.
That's awesome. So in your speaking reel, you also said that never let a problem that needs solved be more important than a person who needs loved. Can you explain about that too?
Yeah. So, I mean, like the biggest thing is our companies aren't made of parts. They're made of people. And so when you go in and the problem that needs to be solved, you're like, oh my gosh, if the problem's more important than the person, you totally screwed up. And that's what leadership is. When leaders can go, oh my gosh, I'm not talking to a problem here. I'm talking to a person that needs to have some correction to make this problem work. And that's always just been the way that I've been able to get through to people. And I think that it's helped me be a better entrepreneur because of it.
Mm. Yeah. And so kind of on the tails of this, I was reading where you were saying how you experience fright daily, fear. I'd love to hear kind of what that looks like for you and how you battle it.
Yeah. So fear is, fear sucks. I actually write that as a title in the book, Fear Sucks. And fear is such a hard thing because it sits on your shoulder every day and it tells you why you won't be able to succeed and why you can't do it. And I have a quote here I'm going to try to pull up here is, fear has kept many would-be leaders on the sidelines. While good opportunities paraded by, they didn't lack insight. They lacked courage. And I think a true leader is someone who has the courage to say publicly what everybody else is whispering privately. It's their insight that sets leaders apart. It's the courage to act on what they see, to speak up when everyone else is silent. And courage, I spoke up for causes. I spoke up for people that want to start their dream, for startupcamp.com. My big thing is just having the courage and the ability to speak up. And I think it gets easier. The way that you get better at fear is that just pushing through it, and the more you push through it, the more positive results you get from pushing through it, the more faith you have coming up to the next fearful thing. You go, you know what? I've been here before. I pushed through it and I won and it feels good and I'll do it again. But those first few times are really hard. And it is faith. It's a total faith thing. You go, you know what? I'm just going to do it. And there's risk, right? Like no one successful has ever gone without risk, like big risk, like ugly, horrific, scary risk. So sometimes you just got to make sure your plan B's are in a row, just make sure that you got a fall plan. Remember, walking a safety net without, or walking a tightrope without a safety net is incredibly dangerous. Just walk with a safety net. It's still crazy to walk on a tightrope, but do it with a safety net. And that's kind of the philosophy I've been using.
And how did you create your safety net? I understand you were writing some things down, right?
Yeah. So I created a list, like my plan B list. I would, I'd put it in the drawer of my desk and it was this list of people that I could fall back on. I'd say, okay, if this falls apart, I can go back and live with my parents. That would suck, right? But I could do that. I could get a job with this guy. I could restart this company. I could do this extra project. I could lean on my savings for 6 months. I could, X, Y, Z, right? And so creating that list, you can then use that list to when you're fearful, you just pull that list out and you go, okay, I'm good. That's my safety net. Like I'm just going to press forward anyways. And it's super scary, but having that list is important and writing it down is important too.
Mm. Awesome. And so I'm curious too, just a little bit more about mindset, because you have so many things going on. When I was looking at your speaking page, it's like every week, it's almost like you're in two different locations or something, just all over. Started 7 companies, the book, so many things going on. How do you stay focused?
Well, it was unsustainable. So I'm now, the last probably 6 months to 9 months, I've completely changed my life around because that, it was a season of really rapid growth. It was way too much. And so now I'm cutting way back. I'm spending more time at home. I moved from Southern California to Bend, Oregon, and I'm living in Central Oregon now. And we bought 7 acres and we're building a new house. And I'm living more of a peaceful life. And what I do now is I try not to work more than 5 hours a day now. It's a luxury, but I mean, I earned that luxury. So you, not everybody can do that right now, but I try to do that, and I try to never work on the weekends if I can.